It's the Afternoon Cruise on Jazz 88. We're chatting with bassist and composer Anthony Cox. Before Traffic, you heard Anthony's playing with J.C. Sanford and Michael Caine on the Wayne Shorter piece Toy Tune. And today, Anthony has shared some of his time to talk about the legacies of two legendary bass players who have birthdays today, Charles Mingus and Paul Chambers. Anthony, thank you so much for taking time to chat with Jazz 88.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, let's start with Paul Chambers. He was born April 22nd, 1935, and he's famous for his time playing with Red Garland, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Wynton Kelly, and some impressive solo work as well. Anthony Cox, when you think about Paul Chambers' style and his influence on the world of music, what comes to mind for you?
Well, I'd say that Paul Chambers was kind of a bridge to the what was to come later in the 60s of the type of bass players where the time was broken up more. I mean, he's really in conjunction with the what was happening, like, say, with Philly Joe Jones and whatnot, you know. There's basically, like, what's going on is a constant 4/4 pulse, you know, but there's little things that Chambers did that showed the things to come. One is like the kind of two feel that he would establish. I'm thinking of, like, when I heard him on If I Were a Bell with Coltrane and Miles from the quintet, that, and then just the thing of, like, putting that triplet on beat four just opened it up, you know. And what was to come later, or you know, as far as bass stylistic changes, you know, like Scott LaFaro or Jimmy Garrison, or, you know, Richard Davis, on and on, was that one thing I noticed I read is that LaFaro really loved Paul Chambers. And what he loved the most was his time, his walk.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize LaFaro also was really strong, straight ahead walker, you know, but he's known for his primarily with his stuff with Bill Evans. But so Paul Chambers, I feel like, and, you know, I rhythm sections throughout the decades, you know, there's this symbiotic relationship. So I'm just thinking of that period, like with the first quintet, especially, you're thinking of Philly Joe and Red Garland. Paul Chambers fits right in there with the, there's still the, you know, the bass drum is, it's there, but it's not heard. But the set's broken up a little bit with Philly Joe. Mm-hmm. I'm not a drummer, so I can't get too technical, you know. But, you know, and there's that interaction between the left hand too, you know, like, say, Philly Joe's snare. And so Chambers kind of is like the glue, and it's like, it's different than, say, like Ron Carter and Tony Williams, where it was real polyrhythmic,
yeah,
you know? So that's, you know, so it fit that time, and it was beautiful. It's funny, because when I started playing, the first player that really influenced me was Mingus, you know, but so I wasn't like, I listened to, you know, Paul Chambers, because, you know, I had all those albums, but it wasn't like I don't know, you know, certain people that really resonate with you, and
right,
some don't. It wasn't like, oh, I don't like him or anything like that, you know, but I do know what was going on, you know. The more I start playing and learning about the music and the tradition, I'm going like, well, that's what's going on. And it's just that, to describe that feel,
yeah,
you know, and I think that's what people, plus he had a huge sound, you know, and it was for the times. He was the contemporary for the times.
I talked a couple years ago about his playing, Paul Chambers' playing, with Jeff Bailey, and one thing Jeff Bailey highlighted was also that Chambers was really like not a reluctant bow player, but an enthusiastic bow player who would play melodies on the bow and could do really fast bebop type of figures on the bow as opposed to just kind of whole note stuff. And he made a big deal of that as kind of being a line in the sand where you go, this guy, he's not begrudgingly playing bow. He wants to do that on some of these tunes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, like a lot of, he took a lot of, on a lot of albums you hear him soloing, and that's not easy to do on a bass because, I mean, that kind of phrasing. String instruments, that's a home. When it gets down to arco playing, there's, you know, there you have to learn a certain way to swing, yeah, you know, to phrase like a horn, because that's what everybody wants to do. No matter what we play, that's what we want to do. When you got a bow and it's that up and down motion, basically, up, bow, down, up, down, up, to get that, you know, and he was using the whole bow, so he's getting the real meat of it. So it has that real, you know, and I mean, that's hard to do, but I commend him for it. I used to go like, I don't think I want to do this, you know, so I'd rather play a melody or something, but, you know, but sometimes I kind of figured out my own way to do it. I said, I think you got to use more of the tip of the bow to articulate, but anyway. But he Jeff was right, you know, like he openly, enthusiastically wanted to do that, you know. And Jimmy Garrison was the same way, you know. Yeah.
It's the Afternoon Cruise. I'm here chatting with Anthony Cox, an outstanding bassist and composer who's joined us to talk about some big birthdays in the world of jazz. And we already talked a little bit about Paul Chambers, but Anthony, I want to talk about somebody who I know was a big influence in your world, which is the one, the only Charles Mingus, who was also born on this day in 1922 in Arizona. With somebody like Mingus, he's recognized for so many different things. Composer, bass player, piano player, label owner, band leader, and somebody who's also just amazing to hear speak about jazz or frankly speak about anything. What drew you, especially when you were getting started, to the work of Charles Mingus?
I think it was the first conception of his compositions and how it was integrated into his bass playing, you know, leading a band that as a bass player and the function, you know, where it was, he led in a way that was won by just the way he could drive a band, but it wasn't always the bass out front, but he was an excellent bass player. I think one of the best, and very innovative. He also, you know, he played arco. He's a beautiful arco player, but you never heard it. But he played more like I was talking about before, like playing melodies. There's recordings of him actually when he played at the Guthrie in 64 with Eric Dolphy. Uh-huh. And he's playing some really beautiful arco lines, high register sounds, because he was studied to player. I think what I liked about me, well, I saw him, see, I was like 19, and he was at the Guthrie in 73. And I guess that's what really floored me. I didn't know anything about music. I mean, I like music, but so as a 19-year-old back then, I was like, yeah, I'm going to go see him. And I knew who he was. And my father had some Mingus albums. So I thought it was going to sound like that. Like my dad had the Clown and some other album I remember, you know. And so for me, that was like old people's music, you know. Anyway, so he comes to the Guthrie, and his lineup was Don Pullen, George Adams, and it was Doug Hammond on drums, and I forgot who was on trumpet. It wasn't Jack Walrath yet, but anyway, he walks out. He had this big guy, Orson Welles. He had this big black smock, you know, and he was smoking a pipe, and you know. And it was just, I don't know, visually. And then the band was dressed like me right now, you know, flannel shirt. And I mean, it was like, they look more like guys in the Grateful Dead or something, you know. They were just like, and then they folded out. I'm telling this because this is the impression. They folded out. They had to have between each musician three music stands. And they folded out the charts, and then it was just like, bam! And then it was just so electrifying. It was just like, I just was floored. And it just, I remember Mingus, the one thing he did was a solo, but then he did a thing where he was like trading with the drums, and they were kind of like soloing together. And it was just powerful, you know? And that was it, you know? I said, that's what I want to do. I want to play that thing, you know? So, yeah. He's so influential, and I think there was a book came out, autobiography, Beneath the Underdog, and it's just, you know, it was like a frustrating career. And I know like by the late 60s, he basically kind of just checked out of the scene. And then he made his comeback with actually that group. And then from then on, as Jack Walrath told me, he said he was like a rock star. I mean, he was on that level, touring. And unfortunately, you know, we lost him. You know, he was only like 50-something, 52, right?
He died in 79 and born in 22. So, yeah, maybe 57, something like that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's too bad. You know, it's too bad. But he did so many great records within that period. Well, all his life. But, I mean, my lifetime, what I heard was the things that came out, like, out on Atlantic. Which were albums like Mingus Moves, Changes Volume 1 and 2. There were some European releases. And then, like I say, that one was a release with the Guthrie, with the band with, I think it was Clifford Jordan, Eric Dolphy, Danny Richman, maybe Jackie Byard. I can't remember exactly. But I know a lot of people haven't heard.
I'm chatting with Anthony Cox. We're celebrating the birthday and legacy of Charles Mingus, born on this day in 1922 in Arizona. Anthony Cox, one thing about Mingus's work is the scope of some of his writing. You just talked about having to pull out multiple music stands for folks to read his work. But he was great at writing a chart, but he's also great at putting together longer pieces of work, and often pieces of work that would be a good fit for a big band or a lot of medium bands. He ran a lot of bands that were like maybe 8 to 12 people. As a fellow jazz writer like yourself, what do you admire about Mingus's ambition as far as like longer pieces and themed pieces and things like that?
Well, you know, he, I know in, it was about 72 maybe, he came out, Columbia, he did Let My Children Hear Music, and that was a larger ensemble, and it was pretty impressive. His larger works, to my knowledge, I might be way off, but not a lot, but the orchestration I did like, you know, I always like the low end tuba, and you know, that's why I like Gil Evans too. You know, it's like, I like that low end and use of the low instruments in a way that really, well, the arrangements are transparent, but at the same time, the lower end starts to become the lead in certain things, you know, and sometimes soul, like so tuba souls. Also, I'm thinking back. In general, I just think, like, when I think of like that album Mingus, and that's not a large ensemble, but you know, yeah, like Goodbye Pork Pie Hat and all. I just that orchestration, that arranging was very, for me, was I was intrigued. It's it has this kind of transparent quality that I like. You know, all the voices speak in a way that's, it's really strong. I just loved it, you know.
I'm absolutely with you, and I feel like his writing and the exact way that he would take his writing and present it for his band was impressive. And he took a lot of work to do this, but he kind of kept that cast of people where obviously Danny Richmond, a fixture in his work for so long, but horn players who would be around for a long time, Waldron would be around for a long time, and he, yeah, like Ellington, would write to those players. So it's one of those things where when you hear Charles Mingus, it's not just hearing him, but it's hearing the cast of players that knew how to do his work properly.
Exactly. And, you know, the other thing, I don't think people know that Mingus was not really, he was really skeptical of bebop. He didn't really take to it at first until he went to New York and heard Charlie Parker. So prior to that, he also did like ghostwriting in Hollywood, you know, and so he thought of, you know, he was really like, he thought of himself as a fully formed composer, and he thought in those ways, you know, and he wasn't really thinking like jazz or that, you know, but instead, yeah, I'm a writer, I mean, you know, a composer, and this is what I want to do. But then when he heard Parker, he realized the possibilities, and he really understood what it was about, you know. So that's another thing, you know, he was coming from a different point of view. Also, I think now I saw this when I was really young. It was on TV, an old PBS or whatever it was called back then. A guy kept stressing, you know, black American music. And he just kind of stopped the guy and said, you know, it's American music, you know? And I think he had that kind of, he thought in a more universal way about the music. And I know he didn't like the word jazz, you know? excuse me, but that's my impression. I think he was so unique in so many ways, you know, a composer, bassist, just his personality, outspoken.
Yeah.
Somewhat of an activist too, you know. And, you know.
There's a couple tunes where I go, hey, if anybody ever tells you like politics has no place in jazz, I go, I mean, there's a lot of places to find examples that say, no, you're dead wrong. But Charles Mingus comes to the top a lot of times with the
and so. Fables of Fabulous, you know, and there was another one about some segregationist, you know, I forgot. But anyway, right. And he had, there was another one. He had a thing where he made his own, you know, I pledge allegiance to the flag, but it was a, you know, he made up his own
pledge.
Yeah.
I've been chatting with Anthony Cox on the occasion of the birthday of Charles Mingus and the birthday of Paul Chambers. And Anthony, we're towards the tail end, but I just really got to say a thank you to you. You're a busy man. You make a lot of incredible music, and you've been an absolute source of inspiration for so many players in Minnesota and beyond, including myself. For you to take time out of your day to chat about these two heroes means a lot to me and means a lot to us. So thank you, Anthony, for doing that.
Oh, you're more than welcome. It's great. I love talking.
Well, we love hearing you talk. I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you for helping us celebrate the birthdays of Charles Mingus and Paul Chambers, and hope to connect with you again soon. And man, this door is wide open. If there's any stuff you want to talk about on Jazz 88, we would be so honored to have you, Anthony.
Oh, great. Thank you. Anytime. It's a pleasure.